Immersive Irony Experience Theme Park Podcast. I am Alan Conceição at Gods on Safari over on Twitter. And this is the place where weird Twitter, perhaps, if you even consider that's a thing that exists, intersects with theme park nonsense. We do have an interview with someone that actually works in the industry for a shocker, right? Mark Rosenzweig from Riot Entertainment will be on in just a few minutes. This episode will be the George the Animal Steel Memorial Podcast, keeping with the general Memorial Podcast theme. Then forgot to actually mention it to Mark. Mark's actually an old school wrestling fan who undoubtedly is crushed by the loss of the former Michigan State alumni turned professional wrestler with essentially a handicapped wild man gimmick. I mean, these are the kind of things that you got to do in the 1970s and 1980s, but, you know, you don't do them so much anymore because it's not cool. Anyways, the podcast is presented to you by absolutely nobody except me and Joe over at parkscope.net. A few side items before we actually get into the podcast interview itself. These are things that came up that have not previously been mentioned on my podcast or the podcast that Joe usually does, the Unprofessional Podcast Hour. So Disneyland Paris, under the Euro Disney name, will be getting bought out by the Walt Disney Company, who was previously the majority shareholder, and will now be looking to control 100% of that company in total. It's somewhat of a major move. It's kind of suspect as to whether or not they're going to spend the kind of money required to do anything with the resort to maybe bring it up to a higher standard, or if that even is going to work in the first place as a method. It's really up in the air as to what the future of that resort is. I don't expect it to close anytime soon, but there's a lot of things that are going on in the EU, in Paris, that are obviously going to affect Disneyland Paris coming up. Sort of lesser known news on sort of the regional end of the amusement and theme park spectrum. For those that are out there looking for any sort of development, anything new that's coming out, Grand Texas Theme Park, which is out in the Houston area, has managed to go ahead and get their go-kart track up and running. It's basically, it's a pro-style go-kart track. So this is not just your standard, two horsepower little go-karts. These are intended for people who are going to be racing go-karts. It goes along with a campground that they already have that's set up. And, they're getting somewhere. They're a long ways away from having a full theme park open, which is part of the plan with the Grand Texas development. That was essentially supposed to be open by now. We're looking at maybe 2019 for an actual theme park to be open on the site. We'll see if it ever happens. About same level of news, there are multiple offers now that have come in for the Jazzland theme park site. Whether or not we actually see a theme park, again, this has been going on now for over a decade at this point. Six Flags New Orleans closed after Hurricane Katrina in 2005, and we're now looking at year 12 of it having been post-devastation. So whether or not we see anything actually happen, again, don't really know. One of the options is a new small-budget theme park. Another option is basically something quite similar to the Creation Museum / Giant Ark Encounter that's located in Kentucky, just over the border with Cincinnati. Again, a lot of talk. As with anything discussing new build parks in the United States, there's often a lot of talk and there's often not very much in terms of action. So those will be things to keep your eye on, but I don't want to get too excited about either one right now. So anyways, this week's interview, Mark Rosenzweig from Ride Entertainment Group. Ride Entertainment Group, I've never heard of them. They're a pretty significant player in the overall themed amusement park industry in the United States. They do a huge, vast number of different things. And I've known Mark for a long time. So, you know, even though we basically just kept it to an hour, we both had lives, you know. We didn't do this at 11 p.m., so we kind of had things to do around it. But I was able to get him to tell some good stories about his time working with Stan Checketts over at SNS, and a little bit about how he got into the industry way, way, way back in the late 1990s, early 2000s with Zamperla and working at Michigan's Adventure. Which was something that I didn't even know until a few years ago that he did for work there in the first place. But Mark's a great guy. I've known him for way longer than I probably would like to admit. You know, I knew him when I was in high school, and I'm starting to gray. So it's been a long time. So anyways, I hope you enjoy the interview. We'll be back in a couple weeks. I think I have a guest lined up, and hopefully they're good. I think they will be. And hope you enjoy.
So I'm going to go ahead and start recording. And this is the podcast. Basically, we call it the Immersive Irony Podcast, because why not? And joining today, somebody that I've known for a good long time from Ride Entertainment, Mr. Mark Rosenzweig. How are you doing today?
I'm excellent. How about you, sir?
I'm alive.
Am I allowed to call you Alan or Ramen Noodles, or what's your name today?
You can go with Alan. Actually, nobody knows about the Ramen Noodles thing within Twitter.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. That's yeah. But now they do.
I didn't. Right. You didn't brief me on which stage name we're using today, so we'll just go with Alan. That's good.
Yeah, Alan's fine. It's too late, man. Like, for this excellent stuff, like, my government name's already out there.
It's true.
It's done with. So you were just on a call, obviously, with somebody important. Basically, explain. So you guys are a ride broker primarily, but you
we don't like that name. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So basically, you guys sell rides. You guys operate mm-hmm. rides. You're a consulting company. Give a short description of what it is that you guys do.
Yeah. Well, basically, you know, because everyone touts that they're the only or the best in what they do, and I'll join that group and tell you, but Ride Entertainment Group, which our website gives a really good overview of what we do and our, you know, our vast years of experience and service. We're, probably the largest multifaceted, company servicing the attractions industry. We have, divisions that sell rides, for multiple manufacturers like Gerstlauer Amusement Rides in Germany, Funtime Handels in Austria. We also do work with Ropes Courses Inc. here, actually not too far from you, down in Elgin, Michigan. And then we have a division that does ride installations and consulting. So essentially, even if, let's say, we're bidding on a roller coaster or a large project and we lose the bid, oftentimes we're still hired to install that ride. So we're kind of like a Switzerland in that regard for the attractions industry, that we really we have our hand on kind of everything.
You're pretty much the one-stop shop in a lot of ways.
Yeah, no, we are. And you know, it's kind of like, and it's built from passion. It's not this, all of our senior management staff, none of us are just doing this because it's a job and it's a 9-to-5, because it is not a 9-to-5, I could tell you that. People always say, wow, it's got to be so cool to work in the attractions industry. And I always say, yeah, try that from February to April and see if you find it fun. It's a very stressful time of year where every North American or Northern Hemisphere park, the seasonal park, is racing to get their new capital installed and open. But in addition to that, so going back to our divisions, we have a division that does financial partnerships, and it's the largest type of division like this in the industry. And by that, it's basically, if you go to a gated theme park or attraction and there is an extra pay attraction, in most cases, our group owns that ride on a financial partnership with the park. And we'll go in and we could do it with our installation division, a full turnkey installation with no capital outlay to the park. So essentially, a lot of the big parks or attractions either don't have the capital to put towards rides or attractions, such as zoos and aquariums, or the larger parks might want to allocate their capital more towards the large rides that drive the gate for the shareholders. So we kind of fill that hole very nicely. And it helps that one of our other companies, which is Sky Coaster, we are the OEM of Sky Coaster, which is the most successful extreme thrill ride in the history of the industry, celebrating 25 years this year, which I think anyone who knows the attractions industry knows it. It's kind of an iconic brand and experience, which is 82 locations around the world right now on 6 continents. We haven't quite cracked the market in Antarctica, but we're working on it. And then, of course, our slingshot rides, which are done through our partnership with Funtime Hondels, which are great, great rides that take up a very minimal footprint, launching guests from the ground to 390 feet in the air in 3 seconds. So, and then our last major division is our operations division, which is really where I think we see our largest potential for growth. We have operations in the city of New York, city of Boston, city of Baltimore, and growing. So we basically have gone in New York City Parks and Recreation. We have Fantasy Forest at the Flushing Meadows Carousel, which is located right in the heart of Flushing Meadows, which is where the New York Hall of Science is, City Field, where the New York Mets lose all the time, the Queen Zoo, which is part of the New York Zoological Society, and then, of course, all the relics from the World's Fair, including the Queens Museum, which has that mind-blowing diorama of the city of New York, which you're into kitchen travel. I'm sure you've seen it, Alan, but anyone needs to see this diorama. It's just mind-blowing. It's worth the admission by itself. So that's the real Reader's Digest in about 2 minutes and 42 seconds. But
that works. Yeah, that's pretty sufficient. Yeah. For a lot of people that are going to be listening to the podcast, most of them are going to come from a background of understanding how Disney and Universal, to some extent, build attractions. I mean, a lot of those people still think that both of those companies just build everything on their own, which is mildly comical. But if you can kind of explain how it is, I'm a park operator, let's say, and I want to build a new $20 million capital expansion project in my park. I want to have a themed ride of some sort, say roller coaster, dark ride, whatever, because you guys do both. Mm-hmm. What's the process that typically takes place? Like, how does that occur?
Well, I think you start. Yeah, well, you start with that number you just threw out there, which is not an everyday number, but you need a budget. So right. what are we looking at for capital year expansion 2018, 2019, et cetera? And then from there, and this generally falls, by the way, if it's an organized corporate group, it will fall within a 5, 10, or 15-year plan, which is, of course, subject to change. The 5-year plan, not so much, but the longer out you project it is subject to change, obviously, based upon changing trends and different needs and changing needs for the property. But a say an average corporate park will have, say, corporate fiscal year 2019. We've decided we're going for a thrill attraction. We need a roller coaster. The budget for this is, make up the number, $12 million. And by that, that's all in. That includes the marketing budget, the ride hardware, all foundation and engineering work, and the entire build out, which a lot of people downplay. But some of these station houses that parks are building these days are millions of dollars on their own, which of course now have to include ADA accessibility, which is either ramps for miles that wheelchairs can go up and down, or an elevator lift. And I can tell you from experience, these elevator lifts are not cheap either, for a piece of hardware that may only need to be used several times a day. So there's that. Then they have to find the site in the park where they want it to go. And then it really depends upon their needs. Some parks, if you're in an isolated market, a ride that has already been designed, or we call them clones sometimes, can fit the bill because it can meet the need of the project. It fit the budget. It could fit the demographic you're going after. And it could be unique to any park within hundreds of miles. The need to have a custom ride design is not as important, say, as in a market like Orlando, where you don't want to have the same ride that your theme park competitor up by four has. So in that case, you would have to decide, are we looking to do a custom ride, which would, of course, involve new engineering and design work, or are we going to take an existing design? Elevations are important in designing a ride because a great example of this I'll give, by the way, is Superman Ultimate Flight, which was the first B&M flying coaster, which debuted in 2002 at Six Flags Over Georgia, hashtag nerd. And it was custom designed for Six Flags property outside of Atlanta, Georgia. It rides the hillside, and it looks impressive when you walk up to it. It looks larger than it really is because of how it's situated and it presents itself. And then a year later, Six Flags opted to have the same ride rubber stamped essentially at their properties in New Jersey and Illinois. And so I would say less of an impressive presentation. It does sit right at the, both rides sit right out in the parking lot, and they do the job. They hit the demographic, they hit the budget. It gave each park a unique ride for their market. So while, say, well-traveled enthusiasts or people who are really into the attractions industry may look at those rides and say, I'm not so excited about them. Six Flags doesn't build rides like this for people who travel thousands of miles with a season pass and don't spend money in their park. They build them for their local season pass and visitation base. So those rides fit the bill and did quite well for all three properties, I think. So
going back to kind of what you guys put together. So obviously you guys do like the construction aspect, you arrange for the acquisition of the ride hardware from the manufacturer that you guys represent. Do you guys typically end up working with any companies like, for instance, the Goddard Group, doing theming, or is that something that's done in-house, or do you guys have anybody you work with?
Well, we do presentations. We do travel around and visit with all the design consultants in the industry, which there are many in the Cincinnati metro area. There are many in Los Angeles, many in Orlando, and then one of the largest, Forec, which is based out of Toronto. And they all have their hands in new theme park design and new projects, which are mainly in China and Dubai and those markets right now. But we do work with them. We make sure that they are constantly updated with what we have in our portfolio, any new partners that we have coming in. We make sure that they know exactly. So as soon as they're kind of checking boxes on their list for a park with regards to attraction selection for a certain demographic, we can put a pretty solid package together to fit all the needs.
So let's talk about, I mean, you guys have worked with just about everybody. You guys have worked with Six Flags. You guys have worked with Cedar Fair increasingly this past year. Mm-hmm. The folks down in Texas, in the Houston area.
Landry's.
Yep. You've done a lot of work with them. Do you guys typically, have you done any presentations as well to, say, Disney, Universal? I'm sure you have to SeaWorld at this point as well.
Yeah. I mean, the annual IAPA Attractions Expo is always a great time. We kind of sit down and have our, call it annual update meeting, where it's almost like a joint interview where we are, we're able to present our existing portfolio, anything that is new, because everyone always wants to know what's new. They want to know what's the next big thing. And we've learned that what you've done in the past is not nearly as important as what you can do in the future. But we do pride ourselves on our customer service. It's one thing that, unlike most sales companies that may not be as involved in a project, we're very involved. We're there to basically, from the before the contract is signed right through commissioning and beyond, we are there to help the customer as sort of a go-between. Because obviously sometimes communication is not as easy between the U.S. and Europe and other markets. So we have vast experience with that. But you know, it really comes down to, again, knowing what the needs are from each park, and meetings at IAPA will typically lead to follow-up meetings throughout the season as a project for another capital year comes up and we have something that can meet that project need essentially. So we will then schedule follow-up meetings and go meet. And, you know, at that point, projects typically will go to the next step if there is opportunity.
So kind of going a slightly different direction. So it's kind of like the dirtier nitty gritty type stuff with what you guys do. A lot of people don't know that Sky Coaster is, pretty much all the Sky Coasters are not owned by the parks, which is, I always find that a very fascinating thing that, especially if you're somebody that operates the Sky Coaster, if you're the site controller for them, you can then operate or ride Sky Coasters free anywhere else in the world.
Just as a disclaimer there, that's not an official policy, but it is something that is typically respected by most parks. If you flash your site controller card, it's not going to get you into nightclubs in New York or Chicago, but it may very well get you a free flight, but we can't guarantee that.
Okay. How did that whole business plan come about? I know that was way before they got involved with Ride Entertainment necessarily, but can you give any background to that? Cause I think that's one of the more fascinating stories.
Which one, the financial partnership division?
Yeah,
or
yeah,
the,
exactly. Yeah, okay. The financial partnership division.
Yeah, well, it basically came to be, you know, when we were working with SNS, this is going back probably to 2001, 2002, and it was kind of one of those deals where ride manufacturers are always coming out with new ride concepts and new ideas. And oftentimes you will, in attempting to sell a new product, you'll hit the wall and that no one wants to be the first. And so kind of like with the mentality of you wouldn't trust a chef who didn't need his own cooking, we would then flip it and say, well, let's find what we deem to be a really good site. And even if it's a prototype ride, let's put it in and we'll back it up. And the park has no capital outlay. And in most cases, they would operate, maintain, and insure it. So, you know, it allowed us to get better acclimated with the ride because we would be right there during the operation because we're partners on it and helping the park do as well as they could with it. But also it would help us market it because it's no longer a drawing on a piece of paper. It's an actual working ride in a park, making money, thrilling riders. So that's really, I would say, if I was going to give you the general broad brushstroke kind of introduction to it, that's really where it was born. And then it kind of took off from there. And you know, there are just a lot of sites that, again, like I was saying, different parks have their mentality is they would rather allocate capital towards the larger rides that drive the gate at the park rather than the attractions, extra pay attractions. So that's kind of the really long story short.
Can you admit anything officially yet about the Sky Coaster at Cedar Point, by the way?
As far as?
Location in the park?
Yeah, I think the park did announce it. I saw on their vlog that they have announced it. It's moving to the Frontier Trail section of the park, and it has a wild new name, which I cannot claim to.
Oh, that's right. You're right. You're absolutely right. Yeah, they did announce that, because now I recall the name is completely ridiculous. And
the name is, I had to ask one of the operations people from the park, because honestly, it didn't hit me. And then I realized it was from the old paddle wheel excursion attraction. There was that one stunt, or I don't know what you want to call it, the animatronic that would roll down on his bike towards that ramp as if he was going to fly over your boat. Whoever that guy is, that's who this ride is named after now.
Yeah, that's right. So basically, I mean, to kind of give people an idea as to how these business things sort of work, the Sky Coaster got moved inside the park. That way it generates revenue. Is that fair to assess?
Yeah. Well, it's fair. And again, this is me just from my understanding. But, you know, Challenge Park, which I believe debuted in 1988, but you could check me on that. I think it debuted the year before Magnum opened, the year that Soak City originally opened. Was a novel idea and a really good idea, because at the time Cedar Point was building up their on-site lodging with Sandcastle Suites and the campground and Hotel Breakers. So they viewed this as a free admission, which unfortunately not many people knew they could access Challenge Park without entering the park. So if you were in Sandusky and just wanted to go ride go-karts, you could essentially, I think you had to still pay the causeway fee, but you could drive around Perimeter Road, park, ride the go-karts, ride the Sky Coaster, and whatever else they had there, play Challenge Golf. But over the course of time, as Cedar Point built up their ride roster, it was becoming increasingly more difficult for guests to get their fill of rides through the day. So I think that contributed a bit to its downfall. And then, of course, the need for expansion at Soak City, I think, was the clincher, where they just couldn't bump east because you're hitting the lake at that point. So they had to come the other way. And so I guess it's just sort of a sign of the times. But yes, moving the Sky Coaster into the park will work wonders for its revenue, because the Slingshot ride that went in 3 years ago is doing really, really well at the site in front of Gemini. So I would expect it's going to do similar numbers.
Kind of going backwards a little bit here, you had mentioned SNS. I know that you had some quality times with Stan Checketts when he was still with the company. Any good stories that I might be able to get out of you while we're around that time?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. Well, on a personal level, I am a low-key Jewish boy from suburbia, so I led a pretty boring upbringing. You know, I lived on the edge of New York City, so I had plenty of culture in my life, but I can't claim to have ever sat on a snowmobile before. And so when I joined Riot Entertainment in 2007, I took a trip out to Utah to meet Stan and the SNS team, because at the time we were selling for them. And I showed up in my my good slacks and my good dress shirt, and I think I had a sport jacket on, but it's a little hazy at this point. My memory is not what it was. And so I walk into the office, and I got a tour of the back warehouse, and I, you know, looking pretty cool. There's Arrow Log Flume boats here because they own Arrow and, you know, sell parts for all their rides and good stuff. And I go upstairs to sit down in their conference room, and we're just discussing ideas for rides and marketing. And this is after I had just come off my 8-year run at Zamprola. So I think they were very curious to get my input on kiddie and family rides, which SNS really only had the Froghopper at the time. So at that, Stan Checkitz walks in the room. He spots me and he said, "You're the new guy, aren't you? Well, let's go. We're going snowmobiling." Now, I've seen snowmobiles, and I think at one time I went to a camp over Christmas break up in the Catskills, and I may have actually ridden on one, you know, with someone else driving, of course, but I'd never driven a snowmobile. And so Stan takes me to the snowmobile rental place in Logan, Utah, which it's Logan, Utah, town of only, you can look up the population, but I don't think it's over 10,000. And of course, they've got multiple snowmobile rental places because that's what you do in the winter. And there's a trail that kind of runs off the road behind his house. And all he says is, "Put on your helmet and follow me." And he said, "One last thing. When we get up to the powder, work against your instinct and turn the opposite way you want to go." And then he's gone. So I have no idea what he just said, but okay, great. So here we're going. We're going up the trails to get to the powder. And truth be told, I was sweating. It was kind of nerve-wracking because these trails had drop-offs of hundreds of feet just on the side, but it was packed, so it was easy to ride on. It was like, you know, just riding on the street, basically. You just had to make sure you didn't run off the side and fall 300 feet. Easy enough. And then we get up to the powder, and this is apparently where the fun stuff starts. And Stan, you know, he takes off and he goes, and I'm trying to keep up with him, and I can't do it. And what he meant by turning left and when you want to go right is when you kind of go up the slope to the left, you want to steer the blades left so that, because you're sliding. If you turn right, what that does is it essentially makes your whole sled slide and flip upside down, which I was not made aware of this. So after flipping upside down three times, and essentially, I have no idea how much snow this is, probably 10 to 12 feet of snow until you hit ground. I'm laying there with the bike on top of me. Stan is nowhere to be found. And then he comes back and he's like, "That was great, wasn't it? It was, you know, like the picture him at one of these East Coaster, no coaster, you know, getting all into it." And he's like, you look like you need a ride. Hop on." So he has, and I don't even know what this is, but it's his sled is a super souped up it's got like the nitro thing going. So it's some secret button he pushes. No joke, Alan. When he pushes this thing and we're going up a 60-degree incline, it felt as though we should have flipped backwards. And we're probably going 40 miles an hour up this hill. And I'm just like beyond. I'm still in my dress clothes. I'm sweating bullets. I'm like in a pool of sweat. We get to the top of the hill. He lets me off. I hear wolves howling and other stuff. I don't even know what's howling, but it's something. It's not suburbia. And he's like, "You stay here and wait. I'm going to go play around a little bit." And he just takes off. And I'm standing here and I'm thinking, now, I got hired to sell for this guy, right? They don't think I'm still with Zamprola and they're just trying to kill off the competition. But anyway, so 5 minutes later, he comes back, picks me up. We go down and then we go have a steak and, you know, everything's good. But that's kind of, you know, and I admire the guy so much because, you know, he's in his 70s, but he's in better shape than you and me combined. And, you know, he could do 20 pull-ups. He can, you know, he's in just spectacular physical and mental shape, and the ideas and the enthusiasm and everything. He really is, you know, in our industry, he is a living legend. You know, it's what it comes down to. And, you know, it's easy to say, well, this ride didn't work or that concept didn't work, but you know what? They're out there. So many people just talk and don't do anything. He has actually done these things. So it's always cool. And those memories are great. And we still play pool and have fun at the industry events, and we'll get together one, you know, a couple times a year as well. But
I'll put you on the spot with one other request for a story, cause it's a good one. The Sonic Boom.
Oh my God. Yeah. I still have my token because you got a token for, let me think how this went. Yeah. It was like, I survived the sonic boom, and literally you survived the sonic boom. So this was a drop ride that he built on the side of what looks like a radio antenna. You can look up the number, but I want to say it was over 400 feet tall, 380 feet tall, maybe. I don't know. But somewhere at that height, it doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. And because it's in Cache Valley, where everything is so spread out, it doesn't look that tall. You know, it's, you know, when you look at something and you have something to compare it to, it's like, wow, that's monstrous. But there's nothing around it, really, and mountains are all in the distance. So, okay, it's a radio antenna. So you walk up to the thing, they open the door, you sit in the capsule, it holds two people, just a seatbelt, and then they give you a headset. I said, why do I need this? Are you going to be like, I thought maybe there was a wireless headset and they're going to be giving us instructions because it's too loud up top or something. But no, you need to wear this or your eardrums will burst. So that's the first warning I should have learned. But okay, I'm there. I'm with Stan. I'm kind of thinking in the mentality, other people have ridden this, so it can't be all that bad. And, you know, you and I are, I think, in the same boat where we've been on so many thrill rides by now. It really takes a thrill ride to make a scream or say, wow, that was, you know, we're kind of numb to it, in other words. So ride starts going up, and it's just like a regular drop ride, and there's a push button. Now, you never rode this?
No, I never made it out. I didn't get out to Utah like 2 or 3 years ago. And
okay,
already merged with Sensei or whatever it is at that point.
Okay. So, you know, you basically have a release button in front of you. You manually release yourself. So at any time, you could just say, I've had enough and I'm going back down. But of course, I couldn't do that. I was riding with some local high school or elementary school. They had a school trip there. So we got to the top. And now there are guy wires all over the place, you know, like a radio antenna. But the thing was flopping at least 3 to 4 feet in each direction. And needless to say, it wasn't very comforting. And they don't give you a countdown. It's not like a 3, 2, 1 fly. You get to the top, you push the button, and I don't know. It felt like an eternity, like all these rides do. But I would venture to say it was a solid 2 to 3 seconds of pure free fall before entering this stack of giant-sized soup cans that creates this air pressure braking system, because there is no braking on the ride. You know that, right?
Yeah.
There's no physical braking system on this ride. Basically, there's an airtight door at the bottom that you enter. If that door is open, you become one with the earth, I guess, because there's no way you're stopping. But with that airtight, the buildup, and I don't know, you know, I can't claim to be an ASTM expert, but I'm going to say that the G forces on this are probably on the high end, because you're going from, I'm not going to say terminal velocity, but what felt like terminal velocity to, okay, get out and do it again in, you know, 1 to 2 seconds. Oh, and the last story about this ride, the sounds it makes. Very interesting sounds. Very interesting sounds.
It's basically creaking metal, and obviously it's loud enough that, is it loud enough to burst your eardrums, or is it an air pressure thing?
Yeah, it's probably both, but if you've been to Busch Gardens Tampa and listened to Falcon's Fury, that ride has very interesting sounds as well. It's probably, I would say, Falcon's Fury is number two on my interesting sounds tower ride list, if I had a tower ride list like that. But Sonic Boom was very special, and I'm happy to say I rode it 4 times that day, and I still have my token, because I don't think it'll ever be recreated.
No, I think you're probably safe in having been on something that very likely none of us will ever get to experience at this stage, barring some sort of miracle. I mean, the Chinese seem to be willing to do anything, and you show the right person a picture of Sonic Boom, you know, very likely it'll cause many people to perish, but
yeah,
who's to say?
And you know, Sonic Boom predates the social media craze. I mean, Facebook was a thing at the time, but people weren't posting videos like they are now. So there really isn't a lot of video. I did a search for it, and there's not a whole lot out there, to be honest with you.
Well, it was also in an extremely rural area. I mean, it's not like you guys were in the middle of Salt Lake City.
Right.
It was part of that SNS amusement park where they basically put a whole bunch of prototypes up and were like, here you
go. It was Stan's. Yeah. It was like his return, you know, his payback to the community. I think he called it Celebration Center or something like that. And, you know, it was nice enough property. It had, I think, two or three extreme rides outside, including a sky coaster that used the Sonic Boom Tower as its launch tower. It actually had the shiv wheel bracket. It cantilevered off the side of the tower. It didn't obviously go 400 feet high, but he had that. He had one of his sky slings out there. And then indoors, there was a pretty sizable arcade, snack bar, and redemption center as well. So it was actually quite nice, I think, for the market. You know, it's just a limited population up there. So
did him building an FEC and having to deal with all the fun stuff like insurance, you think, have anything to do with his departure from SNS? Or do you really know for sure, and you'd be able to tell us?
I don't know. You probably want to email him and let him be your next guest, because, you know, for all the stories I can tell you about him, he could probably stay on 3 hours and tell you stories. So.
That's a good point. Yeah. And he's still out there. Yeah. He's got the Soaring Eagle zip line is what he does now.
Yeah. And trust me when I tell you this, he loves to talk about what he does. So, I mean, if you get in touch with him, I'm sure you'd be able to get him going, and you can almost just hit record and leave for lunch and come back and you'll have plenty of good material.
Well, there, and a month or so, when I finally get to him, we'll get the Stan Checkets.
Right.
Going back to the operation stuff for what you guys do with Ride Entertainment, mm-hmm. you've got Charm City Carousel in Baltimore, you've got the carousels in New York, do you guys run the rides in Central Park, or is that Zamperla?
That's still CAI on the Woolman Ice Rink. And CAI also has Luna Park and then Lot B and C as well. Which is the where the go-karts are, and then of course where the Thunderbolt coaster went. And our sites in New York City, we have Fantasy Forest at Flushing Meadows Carousel, which location I described before. That's kind of our flagship, and the centerpiece of that is the it's a Mangles carousel with Ilion's horses on it. It's interesting story. It's a combination of the Feltman and Stubman carousels from Coney Island. The city of New York bought them both in the late 50s, combined them, and the ride operated as part of the 1964 New York, not quite World's Fair, because it wasn't sanctioned as a World's Fair, but I still would have killed to see it. and then the ride went into storage for a year or two, and then we could do a talk on Robert Moses next week if you want. But so the ride went into storage for a year or two, and then it was placed in its current location strategically right next to the Queen Zoo. And they've gone through multiple operators. And then we won the RFP to operate it. And we also got permission to upgrade the power grid, and we've installed six other rides there. So it's a 1 to 2 hour experience. Now we've got a nice selection of family rides ranging from a Myler kiddie coaster to a Venture Mini Himalaya. We've got two birthday party pavilions. We have food and beverage. We've got several games from Bob Space Racers and Redbone. So it's a really well-rounded facility, and it does extremely well because Flushing Meadows is both a park that tourists visit, but it's also surrounded by residential. And every Sunday morning, you have to see it to believe it. There's like 18 soccer matches going on. The dads come out and play. The moms take the kids to the carousel. It's really a really cool, it's sort of like if you were to ask me to say, what is New York City? That is New York City. You know, it's not Empire State Building or Statue of Liberty. Like, you get into the nitty gritty, you see the communities come out and use the facilities. And that's really what we love about that property. And then we also operate the Forest Park Carousel. We've installed some rides there. That's just about 5 miles away from Flushing. And that's a Daniel Mueller carousel. There are only two Daniel Mueller carousels in operation today. One is the Midway Carousel at Cedar Point, and this is the second one. And it's a gorgeous machine. And we've installed a Rio Grande train next to it, and we're going to be adding some more rides in the coming years. We also have the Pier 62 carousel, which is on Chelsea Piers in Manhattan on the west side, which is generally marketed towards residents who use the Chelsea Piers complex, which is generally you've got basketball courts, you've got the driving range. It's sort of like almost like a high-end YMCA for the residents of that area of New York. It's a really cool complex. I don't know if you've been or not, but and then our probably the most unique and cool ride we operate in New York is the sea glass carousel at the Battery. And when I say carousel, you kind of have to take off your carousel hat. And this isn't one with rounding boards or scenery panels. It's essentially, and to describe it, I could send you photos if you haven't seen it, but it's sort of like the Mad Tea Party type teacup platform with hand sculpted fish that are lit from within, that you sit inside the fish. And there are stationary fish that are off the turntables. And then there are the others that actually that go up and down, and they're synchronized to classical French music scores. And there's, I think, 16 or 17 different ride programs. And the lighting also, so at night, it's a totally different experience. The lighting is customized to go with the music. And it's breathtaking. And again, like I say, I'm numb to rides at this point. I can appreciate a really nice carousel, but this is something totally out of the box that you would expect to see at Disney or Universal. And we're now operating and marketing the ride. So it's owned by the Battery Conservancy, which is not part of New York City Parks per se, but it's a spectacular ride. And then lastly, this year we just took over the operation of an FEC in Staten Island, which is right off of the Staten Island Expressway. It's a pretty bare bones facility, but we think it has a lot of potential. It has go-karts, mini golf, and batting cages as of right now. We're kind of in year one right now, so we're working on a beautification project, which is basically landscaping, flowers, some trees, et cetera. And then we do have long-term plans for it, possibly involving amusement rides, but we want to upgrade the go-karts and do other things. So Staten Island has a very, very strong population base, but we find that most of them don't leave because they can't afford to, because the tolls on the bridges are like $300 or something. So that's an exaggeration, but it's still, you have a market there. They're captive. And
it's mostly residential market too. It's not like a hugely,
exactly.
It's not like somewhere where the people are going and then leaving at 5 o'clock from. Basically they live in Staten Island and take the
ferry. Yeah. They may commute into Manhattan or over to Jersey, but it's not, it doesn't feel urban, but it is very dense. So, there's, I don't know the exact number, but I want to say over 500,000 people live in Staten Island. You can check me on that, but it's a promising market, I think, and it'll do quite well. The Staten Island Yankees have done really well. I mean, the Yankees have a team there, so that's always an indicator. And supposedly this giant wheel that's going to be going near the Staten Island ferry terminal on the Staten Island side is still a go. So
is that one of those world's greatest bassink wheels or whatever?
What's that?
Isn't it a bassink wheel, like one of the world's greatest wheels or whatever they call it, or is it an Intamin one?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah. It's a round wheel.
It's a big round
wheel. It's really tall.
Yeah, and it probably you get.
Yeah, and I guess the thought initially I said, why would you put it there? And then someone said, well, because then you can look at New York. You're not looking. Why would you want to look at away from New York? Essentially, that's the view everyone wants. But still, it's still to be seen, because you still have to ride the ferry to get over there, at least if you're a tourist without a car. So
right. Kind of reminds me, a few years ago, they were going to have a Formula One race for New York City, and they were planning on having it in Hoboken. And the rationale is exactly the same. Like, if we have the cameras here, you can see the city in the background. You'll just be in New Jersey.
Sure. Exactly.
So from the operations perspective for what you guys do, you know, one thing that constantly comes up, whenever I've talked with people in the past, is one of the major detriments or obstacles of operating any sort of amusement industry business type thing is liability insurance. Mm-hmm. Is that like a major item for you guys as well, as far as like what your expenditures are? Like, I guess sort of the dirty question is like, how for you guys or how do you perceive, at least in the industry, like the cost of liability insurance versus the cost, for instance, of labor or something like that in terms of the model of how to run it?
Yeah, well, they're both very important factors, obviously. We've worked insurance is it's sort of a necessary evil. You need to have it regardless. So we kind of look at that as, you know, it's there. It's like, basically, if you want to operate a park, you have to be able to pay your insurance. It's just you can't get around that. Labor on the other side is more flexible. Obviously, on slow days, you can implement a rotating operator program, where if you have the 6 rides to Fantasy Forest, maybe we only have 3 operators there if it's a very slow day, and you just have them rotate to the ride that people want to ride. The big issue with labor specific to New York City and some of the larger cities, I think, on the West Coast, is that minimum wage is on its way to $15. And while that sounds good on paper, it's a big challenge, because we're not selling a product that we can necessarily mark up to correspond to that increase in wage, because people will just not pay to pay to buy tickets anymore. So that's going to be an interesting factor as that approaches. And I think we're 2 years away from that. But either way, it doesn't. We're not planning to close up shop or anything. We'll certainly work with it and figure out a way to make it work. But I think, honestly, that is going to be the bigger challenge than insurance.
Okay. And obviously, you guys, because of the size of your operations, you're not looking at any sort of issues with visas or foreign employees at the moment.
No, you know, because of where we're based, you know, we have currently in the neighborhood of 125 people in our company. If you count all of our operations, we've got 8 senior management, including myself. We generally pull from, you know, in New York City, because the residential base is so strong around our properties, we pull from there. And we feel like that's a very, you know, it looks good to the, you know, we're in that giving back to the community type thing. We're not just there to make money. You know, we're there to be a service to the community. And like I had said earlier, we're all of our management, we're all very passionate about this. We all started out as, I hate to say it, but like posting trip reports on Rec Roller Coaster and other places. So we've been traveling and going out of our way to visit amusement parks well before we were being paid to work in the industry. So we look at this as yes, it's a business and it needs to be in the black, but we're not looking at it as, you know, just take all the cash out of it and, you know, roll out of town. We're looking at it as roll it back in, swap out rides because we don't have enough space to keep adding, and refresh it and continue to do that. And I'm not saying that other operators like us don't do that, but they might be less motivated to do it because we're seeing the positive results both from employing locals and refreshing the product and keeping it relevant.
Do you guys, obviously you're running these, and these are the attractions owned by you, or are they owned by the city or these like nonprofits? In some cases they're owned by the nonprofits like Battery Conservation.
And yeah.
That, right?
It's a mix. New York City owns more historic carousels than any city in the world. From the Mangles Carmel and Prospect Park to the Mangles Carmel and Coney Island, the B&B, the Stein and Goldstein in Central Park, the Forest Park, Mueller, the Illions that we have at Flushing. So you've got all these rides are all owned by city parks. And we are brought in as essentially a concessionaire to operate the ride. But all the additional equipment that we've installed at our properties, we own outright.
Do you guys see any potential growth within kind of the way like cities have gone and built aquatic centers, for instance? Do you see that as a potential outlet for you guys in the future with other cities? Or is it kind of like they're probably going to end up cutting on budgets and more than likely that's not really a future for anywhere outside of like New York City and maybe in this case, Baltimore?
Well, to be honest with you, we almost want them to cut their budgets because we're in a position to come in and do a full turnkey build out. So our mission statement with all that is always basically, would you like, you know, it's almost free revenue if you think of it that way, that we come in, we either lease the land or we pay a percentage of revenue or a mix of both with a guaranteed annual lease. And we can take over a site and essentially do a full build out on a site that wouldn't be used at all. So we can activate a site, help the city make money and also bring more guests to the parks that aren't aware of the parks or are not fully using the amenities. And that's what taxes pay for. Mm-hmm. So you want people to be able to use them and we want to be a part of that. And the really, really short answer is yes, we are actively looking at that and going after it across the country. There is an actual, I think there is a need for it because we've gotten to the point now where I'm sure you've seen this in your travels that real estate costs have caused virtually every mom and pop park to close up shop because they can't justify to operate when they're sitting on land that's worth more than the EBITDA the business generates. So you have family members that want to cash out, they vote, they're done, they're gone. Kitty Land and Melrose Park is a perfect example.
Indiana Beach,
you have a home. Yeah, but at least Indiana Beach is still there.
That's true.
And its future looks brighter now because you have Apex at the helm. Mm-hmm. But Kitty Land is a Home Depot. I mean, how disheartening is that? You have a funky piece of roadside Americana that served Chicagoland for 3 or 4 generations, and now you go buy plywood there. I mean, that just makes me cry. It's not something that should happen. And it's something we're very aware of, and we kind of feel that the next generation of these parks, which are so desperately needed, may very well be in city parks because that's where kids go with families already. So instead of trying to build on land that you would have to lease because no one can afford to purchase these parcels in developed areas, let's go into parks and we look at it as we're strengthening the park. We're bringing a new marketable entity there that people can use and enjoy, have their birthday party at. And really, I look at it as bring back the 1950s kiddie park, because they were so successful. They're so needed. And you go to any suburban area now, and there's no attractions. There's nothing to do. There's only places to consume, whether it's purchasing or eating or drinking. It's very disheartening from my memories as a child, where it would be, let's go play mini golf and go eat at Howard Johnson. Now it's, let's go to the mall and go to the Gap and go to Abercrombie and go, you know, wherever. It's a sign of the times, and I understand that. But, and I know that the competition for the entertainment dollar, everyone will always tell me, is stronger than it's ever been, and it's very difficult. But I still think there is a need for that. I think there's something to be said for getting off your tablet, smartphone, and device, and, you know, getting on a ride with your three-year-old child and see that smile in their face for the first time and make you realize what, you know, life is about. Or, and I don't want to sound all corny with that, but I hope you get where I'm going with this.
I get exactly where you're going. And you know what? Yeah. I would also point out that, you know, when you talk about how pretty much suburbia is an endless, you know, sea of big box stores and generic looking shopping malls, that stuff's dying out because it's pretty much, it's been repeated so often. I mean, how many Home Depots does the world need? How many times do you really need to go to Sears when you have Amazon? Like it's an item that's completely replaceable, whereas experiences are not replaceable.
And also think of this. I mean, what is going to become of all these vacated anchor stores and shopping malls? With all the Macy's and Sears going away and the Best Buy's going away. And, you know, when you can walk into these places almost as a way to touch something and see if you like it, and then you buy it for less money on Amazon and not pay tax. So what's going to happen? Are these structures going to eventually become the home of attractions? Perhaps. I don't know. It's interesting, if you drive from MCO Airport in Orlando towards iDrive, you'll notice the Florida Mall, Nordstrom closed up shop, and it is now a Crayola World, of all things. They didn't change the exterior of the building. They just colored it in bright yellow and green and red and everything else. And apparently it's doing quite well.
There's Artagon, which just closed up in Orlando, and that's been cited as a potential spot. I'm sure you've heard, you know, there's some rumor about an international amusement park company was interested in it, which immediately made me think Parque Reunidos would be the only one that made any sense. I can't see Six Flags or Cedar Fair pursuing a construction project there, but
could be Triple Five too.
Yeah, I picture something like a giant indoor FEC or something for that space. I think people are desiring a 300-acre thrill park, and if they want that, they should just wait until SeaWorld inevitably gets sold to somebody.
Right,
but that's neither here nor there. So we only got a few minutes left here. Why go backwards? How you got introduced to the industry. So you worked at Michigan's Adventure, which I somehow did not know for a long time.
Okay.
You lived in New York, and you basically, my recollection of the story is you applied for a job there because had you graduated college yet, or were you like a senior?
Well, I was in my senior year, and all my friends were applying for quote unquote real jobs. I'll date this so you can picture when it is, 1998. So this is when tech was booming, the first round of tech. So a lot of people were going to work for companies like Computer Associates and the like. And that all just made me depressed because I'm kind of like, you know, whether or not you believe in the afterlife, I don't want to really chance it. I just kind of want to say I'm going to live one time. I want to do something I love. And I know that sounds corny and impossible to most middle class people who say just get a job and shut up. But I'm sitting talking to one of the counselors at my school, which was State University of New York College at Oneonta, which is upstate, not far from Cooperstown in Albany. And I told her, I said, this is what I really want to do. The challenge is that getting a full-time job seems to be impossible without experience. So they advise just send out resumes and try to get a summer job. Now, mind you, most people trying to get these jobs were not 22-year-old college graduates. They were 17 and 18-year-old kids that their parents were kicking out of the house to get a job. So I kind of looked a little bit out of place. And, you know, I would get replies back. Cedar Point offered me a position on the Cedar Creek Mine Ride, which I recalled was one of those manual lap bar release things. And I picture my back just being a mess all summer working
and
6 hours.
The record.
Yeah, exactly.
Nothing has changed.
Right. So, they didn't have seatbelts at the time, though, so that would have been.
Yeah, that's true.
But anyways, So we go back, and then Michigan's Adventure, I actually got a call, and this was to my dorm room, because this is obviously before cell phones. It was the director of operations, and she was very inquisitive or very confused as to why I even wanted to work there or how I even found out about the place. This is well before Cedar Fair bought the park too. So I talked to her and explained, and I said, I don't know that I have the time to come out there to interview or see you in person, but I'm prepared to find an apartment and give it a go. So they offered me what was called a team leader position, which is basically one step above ride operator, where my main job was to organize and manage an area of the park. In other words, make sure it's clean, work with park services on that, make sure staffing is proper and all the rides are staffed, make sure that everyone got their breaks at the appropriate time, you know, based upon whatever Michigan labor laws were at the time. So I was basically in the Shivering Timbers Wolverine Wildcat area, rotating between those two rides, and I'm going to draw a blank. We had the Chaos ride at the time, the one that almost rolled into the parking lot.
Yes.
That was in that back corner. And then we had the Trabant ride, and we had the Sea Dragon. Those were the rides in our area. The Log Flume fell to the next area. So I basically bounced between those rides, giving breaks, making sure everything was running smoothly. And, you know, it was actually a lot of fun. I mean, it was a lot of hours, but it wasn't one of those jobs that you had to be real cerebral and, you know, think about budgets and all that. You just went out and did your job. So it was great. I did come to a conclusion after that summer, two things. One, I didn't want to live in Western Michigan. And two, I didn't want to work in operations in a park, because I saw how seemingly thankless it was that you were basically expected to do something. And the only time anything was ever brought up to you is when it was a negative. There's never any positive, never a positive.
No positive reinforcement.
You know, coming. Yeah. That was the word. I'm at the end of my very long week here. So thank you. So I went back to New York, got a couple jobs here. They actually worked in a Nordstrom in their men's department for a while, which pays surprisingly well. If you do well in sales, you can make decent commission there, and kept searching. And, I remember like yesterday, I'd just come home with my brand new shiny IBM computer. I think I paid like $2,200 for it. Crazy. Hooked up to my dial-up modem. And I was, you know, loading every website in the industry, like waiting 4 minutes for Cedar Point's website to load, waiting, you know, whatever it was. And I found Zamperla located in New York. I knew them as an Italian manufacturer. I did not know them as having a U.S. presence. I didn't really know the industry very intimately at the time. So almost cold call style, I called them. And for whatever reason, I got right through to Valerio Ferrari, who is currently their, I believe, president. I don't know his exact title, but he basically runs all of their U.S. operations from Zamperla Inc., which is their U.S. sales office in Parsippany. And he's also the president of Central Amusements. And, you know, he's got a great story in that, you know, he, engineering background, military background in Italy, and he was hired in a temporary role to project manage the Zamperla ride installations at Disneyland Paris in 1990 and 91. Did that park open in 92? Do you know off the top of your head?
Yeah, 92.
Okay, so he was there, 2 years leading up to the opening. So he was overseeing the installation of Peter Pan's Flight, Dumbo the Flying Elephant, the Mad Tea Party, all the hardware that Zamperla had been contracted to build. But of course, they can't claim it because it's at a Disney park. And so he did so well that Mr. Zamperla offered him the position to come over and run the U.S. operation. And, you know, really, really great engineer, really, really knowledgeable in the industry as well. So within a week, I was in there interviewing with him and the director of sales, Ramon Rosario, who turned out to be sort of my mentor through my early years in the industry. And I was offered the job, and I started 2 weeks later. It just so happened that their former director of sales had left. Ramon had just taken over. And so a position had opened basically as a sales and marketing manager. And, you know, I was almost paying them to work. That's how little I was being paid. I mean, I'll tell anyone the story, but I didn't care because I'm like, okay, wait a minute. You're going to pay me to go to amusement parks. Okay, that sounds good. Let me do this. of course, I had to sell rides and do all that, which was great. And I did okay first couple years. And then my first big project was at Silver Dollar City, where we did the Grand Exposition area, which is a 10-ride package that I had a very heavy hand in the ride selection. It was a lot of fun doing that because they're very Silver Dollar City, off the top, and I think you'll agree, might be the most underrated park in the world.
At least for North America.
Sure. It's for me, it's a top five all-time park. And I've been to the Europas. I've been to the Disneylands. I've been to the Cedar Points. I've been to the Knoebels. It's right there. It's such a wonderful property. It's so funky. It does not have this, you know, the loop layout. It's just sort of like free form. It's grown as it's gone. Let's say you could just like walk right through the heart of the park and stumble upon a, what is that? Grandfather's Mansion.
Grandfather's Mansion. Yeah.
Yeah. Or take a cave tour. It's such a great diverse mix of attractions there. I could easily spend 2 or 3 days there, not tire of it. But anyway, so their team was super fun. And I think they bought into my enthusiasm and Ramon's enthusiasm. And we actually took them on these tours. They wanted to see all the rides we were proposing. So we had them fly out, say, to Newark Airport, New Jersey. And we would take them to Dorney Park. And then we went to Knoebels. And of course, you go to Knoebels, you have Mr. Knoebel, who is always the greatest host ever, his whole family. And they heard Silver Dollar City's here. Wow, we got to meet these guys that come out. So we had food. We got them to ride the flying carousel, the wave swinger, which they wound up purchasing as part of the package at Silver Dollar. And then, of course, after the park closed, let's go ride the Phoenix. So he brings over the maintenance guys, fire it up just for us. And they turn out the chaser lights and they send us around 5 times. And I have to say that moment, you know, our relationships all built on our industries built on relationships. That was the bonding moment. That was the time we're all together. We're the only people on the train. They're sending it around. We're in the middle of Pennsylvania. No place that any of them would ever go previous to that. So just a lot of fun. And we were able to put that package together and see it really come to fruition, because I don't know if you were aware, but the area was built on what was formerly an employee parking lot.
I actually did not know that.
Okay, well, that's part of why when it was new, it lacked the mature vegetation or landscaping or trees that the rest of the park had. Whereas when Dollywood redid their county fair area 1 year prior, it was essentially just refreshing the ride mix in an existing area of the park. So Silver Dollar City didn't have that benefit, but I did get a chance to go back and visit for the first time in many years. And I was happy to see the trees had finally grown in, and it really looks as though it's an area of the park that's been there all along. So that was really, really cool, really neat. Probably the pinnacle of my years at San Perla, I would say. But it was a great learning experience to go there, and then coming to Ride Entertainment, where I already was close friends with Adam Sandy, who he started an amusement business. He was selling ads there, and then he joined Ride Entertainment. And then as Ride Entertainment started growing and pushing out different divisions, there came an opening. And I had pretty well hit my ceiling at San Perla with what I was doing. So I came over here, and it's been fantastic ever since, living in Baltimore and really enjoying it. And it's been a great place to raise a family. And I can't really say too much else. It's kind of like the random closure on the whole thing, but it's definitely, I tell anyone that'll listen that, and I do this when I go out and do Sky Coaster site visits, when we're observing and testing new site controller candidates, is that I'm living proof that if you really love the industry, just keep working at it and you could find a full-time job and it could be part of your life. And it's a great industry. I mean, I can't say anything bad about it. I mean, it has stresses like any other job, but at least at the end of the day, I'm not selling refrigerators.
this is very true. I guess we'll close, because I know both of us are kind of busy today with two items. One, if you want to get involved in the theme park industry, it sounds like you should start by selling suits and then sell rides. And second part is, we never even got to discuss how you're to blame for the Volare.
Well, why don't we do maybe in 2 or 3 weeks we can revisit that.
Something like that. That seems like a decent idea.
Yeah. Let's end this on an up note.
Okay. We'll scratch the whole part about the Volare for now. So anyways, Mark, great to talk with you. I haven't gotten to talk with you via actual voice rather than textual communication in probably 5 years. Hopefully we get to do this again sometime soon.
No, man, we played pinball together about a year and a half ago.
Oh, dear Lord. You're right. That was in Grand Rapids, wasn't it?
Exactly. Yeah.
Time. I'm not any better with my memory now than at any point in the past. Like, it's not getting better. I know this. Unfortunately, this is what I also study now. This is my work.
This is right. I know.
It's not good.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for answering the call when I needed someone at the last minute. Mark Rosenzweig from Riot Entertainment. Thanks for appearing.
Absolutely. We'll talk to you guys soon.
All right. That was the interview with Mark. Remember to go ahead and follow us at Parkscope on Twitter. You can also follow Mark or Mark's company, to be more specific, at RideENT on Twitter. They also do have a Facebook page as well. Again, I'm Alan Conseil at Gods on Safari. Hope you enjoyed the interview, and make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes. I don't have a catchy phrase to get out of here, so peace.